Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
Columnist reporters and commentators for Sports Illustrated, ESPN, and various other outlets devoted to our games have often taken their shots at the NCAA. But when a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian writing for a magazine more inclined to cover politics, economics, and the arts than sports hammers the governing body of college athletics, attention must be paid. So this week I spoke with Taylor Branch, who wrote an article titled "The Shame of College Sports" for the current issue of the Atlantic Monthly. I began our conversation by observing that we take the term student-athlete for granted and asking Mr. Branch about how and why that designation had come into use.
It was done in the early 1950s, according to Walter Byers, the head of the NCAA, who said it was explicitly codified and created to help defend the NCAA and colleges in lawsuits and workmen's compensation cases by injured athletes. Basically, colleges did not want to have to pay medical bills for particularly football players who broke their necks. So they created this term to resist workmen compensation lawsuits, saying that the players were not really just players at the university, which would make them look like employees, and they were not merely students who happened to be playing, because that would undercut their obligations as athletes. They were student athletes, which was this specialized category. It's a pretty cynical thing. I was surprised. I had no idea of this going in, but there's a long record of victories or denials for these athletes being able to get medical coverage.
Well, that perhaps is the most surprising thing. This cynical hoax worked. The court said, yeah, they're not entitled to compensation because somehow they're not doing a duty or an obligation at the university.
Right. They're saying this. The schools are not in the football business, therefore the players are not employees. There are all kinds of very, very complicated criteria in labor law for what constitutes an employee, and clearly college players meet nearly all of them. Does the employer supply equipment? Does the employer control the time and circumstances of work? Does the employer provide any compensation, set the rules, and so on and so forth? But the courts have widely deferred to the NCAA and to the concept of amateurism. I guess the concept of the student-athlete helps them essentially defer to the NCAA and rule in favor of the colleges.
You refer to, quote, two of the noble principles on which the NCAA justifies its existence, amateurism and student-athlete, as, quote, cynical hoaxes, legalistic confections propagated by the universities so they can exploit the skills and fame of young athletes. What are some of the particulars that led you to that conclusion?
Well, it's pretty hard because nearly everybody I talk to bridles at the idea of paying these student-athletes. And the principle by which we don't pay them is called amateurism, meaning that we enshrine the notion that they're supposed to be amateurs and doing this for the sheer love of the game, and therefore they shouldn't want to be paid. But the problem with that is that amateurism is a profession or something that one should want to do for the love of it, kind of like a spiritual faith. To impose amateurism on someone else, you've got to have some sort of stronger basis. There is none in law. Nowhere is it illegal to pay college players or for college players to seek to be paid, since they're generating millions of dollars in income. It can only be done by a tradition or by a cartel or a conspiracy. And the colleges have done that. They know it's not legal. They know there's no really strong basis for it, which is why whenever you see a penalty announced in one of the scandals at Ohio State or Florida State or North Carolina or anywhere, the wording is the NCAA says that the colleges imposed the penalties on themselves, and the colleges say that the penalties were imposed in consultation with the NCAA. It comes from kind of a never land or a twilight zone, because it has no legal sanction. If you could write a law to enforce this, you know, then you could get the courts and grand juries and criminal sanctions involved, which is what the dream of a lot of sports writers. But you can't. So that's why amateurism is a hoax. It applies only to this one category of people who work hard to generate a lot of money, but we have a system set up so that they don't get any of it, and it's all reserved to the adults and the institutions.
You found in the NCAA's governance system, quote, the unmistakable whiff of the plantation, end quote. But football and basketball players who are recruited by universities have aspired to be recruited. They know what they're getting into, don't they?
Well, certainly, but they don't have any alternative because the NCAA prohibits colleges from offering them any money and prohibits players from bargaining for their services. So it is a cartel in that sense. If any college, if the University of Texas were to say this recruit is so great that we're going to give him a scholarship plus $10,000 a year or put $10,000 in escrow so that he'll have a nest egg when he graduates, the NCAA would punish them for it because it's a violation of amateurism. It's not doesn't violate any law any more than if you're a graduate teacher and you want to teach, the university can pay you to teach and you can bargain for your salary. If you are an undergraduate and you want to work in the campus bookstore, you can bargain for your salary there. But if you're an athlete, not only can you not bargain for your salary above your scholarship, but you can't even bargain for the terms of your scholarship or anything else because the NCAA has these rules that it imposes without benefit of law.
Over 25 years ago, the Supreme Court essentially eliminated the NCAA's stranglehold on college football. How has the organization been able to maintain control of the annual basketball tournament, which is the main source of the NCAA's income?
That's a very good question, only precariously. For its first 30 years, the NCAA controlled both all football contracts with television and all basketball. Then the football schools revolted, and they said, we don't want to do this. We want to control our own money, which is part of the rampant professionalization of college sports for the adults, but not for the actual players. So the coaches and the schools can make all the money they want according to free market principles for our economy. What saved the NCAA when the football schools revolted and took half their treasury was that it occurred right at the time when the March Madness basketball tournament was taking off, and its income skyrocketed 50-fold in 30 years. They now get $771 million directly in a check from the network, CBS Turner in this case, to the NCAA, which uses it to pay all the 1,000-member colleges and the winners of the tournament and the whole NCAA budget. 95% of its budget comes from this one tournament. And the NCAA's great precarious fear is that the big football schools that took football away could take basketball away, too.
You quote Dale Brown, who was paid millions of dollars to coach men's basketball at LSU from 1972 until 1997, and he says, and I'm quoting now, look at the money we make off predominantly poor black kids. We're the whoremasters. I don't want to seem cynical, but has any coach who hasn't retired said anything like that?
No, and the quote right before that is Nick Saban saying that agents, you know, professional agents, the ones who try to recruit college players are pimps. Most coaches deflect the blame or any criticism on to those who provide benefits for the players and for the players who seek those benefits, that this is a terrible thing that this exploits the players. The reason that we don't have an intelligent debate that should matter to all Americans about whether professionalized sports can coexist with higher education is because the NCAA rules and, quite frankly, the sports press have allowed us, brainwashed us into thinking that the real problem are dirty athletes who are taking money under the table. These dirty athletes are working hard. They are generating lots of money, and in any other profession, they'd be perfectly entitled, indeed exalted, for trying to make their way in the world for getting paid for what they do.
Well, you write that these stories of abuses are in fact distractions and that the much more significant issue is, quote, the denial of fundamental due process for college athletes. How do we address that?
Well, it is a legal question whether they should be entitled to due process. The courts tend to get misty-eyed and deferred to this and say, yes, we adults should regulate these amateurs, but they do that without any basis in law. Congress changed the Olympics. You know, the Olympics used to be as amateur as college sports.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1978, Congress passed the Amateur Sports Act, which took the control of our Olympic teams away from the Amateur Athletic Union and gave them to 39 Olympic committees, each of whom allowed current athletes to have a voting stake in Olympic policy. And within 10 years, the Olympics went pro, not only in the United States, but around the world. The Olympic Committee expunged the word amateur from its charter in 1986. Michael Phelps can make millions of dollars and swim in the Olympics, but he couldn't swim on his team at the college team at the University of Michigan because the NCAA required him to be an amateur and not even appear at the meet.
Various studies produced by the Knight Commission and other groups have suggested ways in which the NCAA might be reformed. University presidents should take control of their athletic departments rather than letting them operate as separate entities. Stiffer penalties should be assessed against schools that break the rules, things like that. Has there ever been any real reform of the system?
I want to be careful here. I think, and I wrote about this a little bit in ways that didn't make this article, but I hope to publish elsewhere. The NCAA has made some effort in academic standards, in reforming schools on their graduation rates and things like that that don't really pertain to money, but have to do with academic standards. Anything, though, on the core issue of amateurism, and the principle that, in the NCAA's eyes, that athletes should get nothing beyond their scholarship, not a tattoo, not anything, not a Christmas card for their mother. There's been no reform on that, and I think the reason is because even the reformers do not want to raise the basic issue, which is, what is the justification for amateurism? If it's so important, why can't it be put in law? Why is it only for college athletes? None of these questions is raised. And in fact, to me, the great scandal is that they're not only not raised at the NCAA and by reformers, but they're not raised on our leading colleges and universities, which are supposed to be incubators of independent thought.
Let's assume that the NCAA is reformed or that some of these changes that you're suggesting do occur. What would be the trickle-down theory on non-revenue sports that depend on football and basketball generating a lot of money for their very existence?
Well, we don't really know, but at least it would be an honest and acknowledged relationship. Right now, the revenue athletes are asked to and demanded to subsidize not only a lot of extra coaches and lavish facilities, but also the players from the sports that don't produce their own revenue. I mean, it would be an honest relationship. I don't know exactly how it would happen. Of course, if I were at a college, I'd be very loath to see the revenue sports gobble up all the others so that the only sports you offered were the ones that made money. But if they did, then, as Dick Vidur, the athletic director at Chapel Hill, told me, he said we would have to think long and hard about whether we wanted to continue sports under these conditions. And there are a number of reformers who say that big money sports don't really belong in all of these schools. We're the only country in the world that houses big money sports in institutions of higher learning. And we need to figure out whether or not that's a good thing to do.
The NCAA is currently facing lawsuits brought by former players regarding their rights to their own images. Some of the conferences have become restless under the NCAA's yoke. The public is probably now more skeptical than ever about the integrity of college football and basketball. Is the system ripe for change?
I think so, yes. There are a number of different things pulling at the NCAA in a number of different directions. I mean, think about it on its face. The NCAA gets all its revenue from basketball, and yet is supposed to, and none from football, and yet sets itself up to enforce amateurism rules across the board. They have a vested interest in having enforcements on football where they get no revenue, as opposed to basketball where they are utterly dependent for all of their money. It is an inherently unstable and, in my view, unjustified system because it doesn't rest on any principle or law. So, yes, I think now is the time for change. I'm just hoping that there can be some real debate on how we go about this.
Assuming that college sports is going to continue to have a governing body, how should that body operate?
First of all, it should be open, and it should include the athletes themselves as members. One of the reasons that the student-athlete formulation worked back in the 1950s to set in motion this unfair structure is that the athletes are not members of the NCAA. They have no vote, they have no membership, they have no representation. It's only the institution. But they're providing such a critical element that they should have some voting representation just as the Olympic athletes do. These kids are maintaining dual careers that are enormously demanding, both as students and as athletes. There may be a question whether it's practical to have professional sports and quality education coexist, but we don't have that debate right now because we're so diverted on all these phony scandals.
Pulitzer Prize winner Taylor Branch is the author of Parting the Waters, The Clinton Tapes, and many other books. His article titled The Shame of College Sports appears in the current issue of The Atlantic Monthly. Mr. Branch, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. Enjoy being with you.
My conversation with Taylor Branch will be featured on this week's program. I'll also be talking with our baseball guy, Tim Kirchin, about the dwindling regular season and his playoff projections. We'll have a story about this season's most accomplished pitcher, Justin Verlander of the Tigers, 23 wins and counting. Believe it or not, we'll have a story about competitive tomahawk tossing as well. And I'll be discussing fantasy sports with a professional fantasy sports analyst. Because who else would you want discussing fantasy sports? So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.